another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Jed Hartley, son of a false prophet that's been banned from Bethel and a former member of the International House of Prayer. Jed, this is going to be a little bit odd for the audience because this one is out of sequence. You and I record quite a bit ahead, and we're going to inject this one, so we may say some things that we have already said in the future. And I'm a big fan of the Back to the Future movies, so this makes me feel all powerful, and I do have a flux capacitor over here on my desk, so but anyway, we're talking about the big news. Bethel is finally changing some of their patterns, and it goes back to something that I've been saying as a theme for quite a long time. There are really some good people that are caught up in the system who recognize that everything that they're doing is wrong, or many of the things they're doing is wrong, but the system is so out of control. How do you stop it? And so I'm going to give people in Bethel the benefit of the doubt. This was the right choice. They made the right choice, and I want to talk through the right choice with you.
Yeah. I mean, they posted it was so eerie for me because I get a phone call from my cousin, and he says, "Hey, have you seen what Bethel posted?" He said that he was seen from news organizations that Bethel has officially cut ties with your dad, which I had not heard and not seen, and I had not heard from Bethel. Like, they did not let me know that they were going to be doing this. I didn't hear it from my dad. I don't keep in great contact with my dad, but he will send me text messages quite often about things that are going on, sometimes rather charged emotional text messages. So I'm surprised that I didn't see this coming from him. So chances are he had not been told that this was going to happen. But Bethel releases on May 28th, they release a statement called Bethel's Position on Ministry Platform, and it's just sort of them acknowledging that they carry weight and responsibility, and they want to uphold biblical principles, and basically they're starting to recognize that they are responsible for the men and women, but mainly men, that they platform on their ministry, and they give this large platform. They have a statement about, "We will not make decisions about platforming based solely on rumors, pressure, or unverified claims." So I think in this, they were kind of talking about, like, okay, well, so for the ministers that we do platform, if they are involved in scandal, we're not going to make any decisions about removing them from our platform based just solely on rumors, pressure, or unverified claims. But then at the same time, credible concerns may lead to further review, discernment through appropriate reporting and accountability process. Then later, following internal review and discussion, we've made the decision to confirm publicly that we no longer platform the following individuals: Todd Bentley, Mike Bickle, Sean Bowles, and Bob Hartley. And then there's the final paragraph is specifically regarding Bob Hartley. So specifically regarding Bob Hartley, Bethel took action after concerns were raised in previous years. We restricted his ministry involvement, informed our church community, and later limited his access to Bethel campus. As part of our current review, we want to clearly state that Bob Hartley is not endorsed, platformed, or permitted to serve in ministry influence at Bethel. I do not know why they particularly emphasize my dad on that. It could be because of some of my continued conversation around it. It could be because he was the only one in which there was several sort of years where, I mean, back in 2015, they had heard that he was doing things that were inappropriate. It's still a little bit hazy to me when Bethel was informed of what behaviors, but certainly about prophetic abuse, and then later I will use the word sexual indiscretion, but I think that sexual harassment to sexual abuse is probably more appropriate. The things that they heard about that, I think, were later, or they heard some things in 2015, some things in 2017, some things later in 2023 when I finally was aware of many of these things and called them and put some external pressure on them. And then in 2024 or maybe even 2025, I think, when Mike Winger posted a large interview with me and Michelle Seidler, and that is when Bethel officially had much more attention on them, and that's when they did it. So perhaps there is this paragraph just about Bob Hartley because of the sequence of events, and because there were several instances in which they should have publicly distanced themselves from him and should have negated sort of his platform, and they didn't. I don't know if that's what they're clarifying or not. Again, I have no idea because they never spoke to me about this. I'm kind of reacting with you, John, and with everyone, because this is fresh for me. I'll ask you, John, when you see that and you see those four names and then Bob Hartley, there's that special paragraph on the end for Bob Hartley. Do you have any thoughts on why they might be doing that?
I have so many thoughts, man. So I look at this from a person who's on the outside looking in. I was never part of this thing. I was part of what made this. And there are a few things that come to mind. Number one, the Bob Hartley thing. It's hard to say why exactly they chose that. I would say that you and I could have had an impact, as has everyone else who is doing this. Every single person who's doing what we're doing and just crying out, hey, man, there's danger in this water. Don't swim. Eventually, the lifeguards are going to step in and say, hey, okay, we got to stop swimming in this place. I mean,
yeah,
I hate to say it, but that's the way it is. I look at it. So when I read this, I read it different than most people. Whenever I first read it and just saw the headlines and the glances through it, my first inclination is like everybody else. Okay, they did the right thing. This is really good. Then I look at it from the perspective of historian. And if you read it like this, it reads quite a bit differently. And I want to talk about that, not to negate anything that they did that is good, because this is a step in the right direction. I'll say it like that.
Yeah.
But the problem that exists, if you read this, even in their own verbiage, the problem that exists, they're platforming people. I mean, what church does this? You go to a church, you want to hear the minister, you want to hear the gospel. You're not coming to be excited about a human. You're coming to be excited about God. And this whole article is literally declaring that this is an entertainment church. This is not a church that's dedicated. We're not platforming Jesus. We're platforming these individuals. And oh my gosh, look what these individuals have done. I mean, that's what it reads from the historian standpoint. Whether it's your dad, whether it's any of these other names they mentioned, the real problem is, and I think eventually, if they continue in the same direction, when they realize that, okay, something's wrong here, let's change course, eventually they're going to come to a decision point. And that decision point is either this church will no longer focus on humans, we're going to focus on God. And if you come to our church, we want you to get connected to God. We do not want you to see an individual as this superhuman or super apostle. They're going to either make the decision to basically to be a Christian church or to be an entertainment church. And I think that's what has to happen when you go down this direction. You're making a move in the right direction, but until you make that decision that, okay, we decided we're going to be a Christian church, until you make that decision, you've not really addressed the root of the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that that's an excellent point. And I think that them calling it an entertainment church, I mean, two things that this statement kind of verifies. One, it exactly what you're saying. It really is a explicit, I don't want to say confession, because I don't think that you view it as a confession, but it's an explicit acknowledgement of exactly what you're saying, of like, they are a platforming church, that they are entertainment, that this is something more than what a church is. This is a entertainment sort of industry, and music and ministry and everything that goes along with it. I mean, I think that they are now, whatever, 20 years. I mean, it's been a church for a long time, but they've really been in the limelight for 20, 30 years. They are now, I think, this is the first time they're really reckoning with the fact that as an entertainment, and like, it's, they are now platforming people that they haven't walked with for years and know. And I mean, that's the thing with the church, is that typically in churches you are able to platform, and by platform I mean have ministers or have pastors who you have known for years and years and years, who know your community, who are a part of the community. But this, when it is this sort of media mogul, when it is this entertainment industry, you don't know who is really coming to share, and you don't know much about them. And if they are entertaining and compelling, the message, oh, I shouldn't even say the message, the clicks, the entertainment, outweighs the cost of doing your due diligence of recognizing whether or not this person is legitimate. Like, I if you had pressed my father back in 2010, it would have been pretty easy to understand that he was doing false prophetic, that he was getting information from not divine means, that wouldn't have taken a very thorough investigation. But because, especially back then, my father was kind of peaking with his whole persona, and he was a very entertaining product back in 2010 for some people. He turned a lot of people off but there was a lot of people who really found his performance enticing. And I don't mean to say that disparaging the people who did, because I was one of them. Like, I very much bought it hook, line, and sinker when I was in my teens, and then started when I was in my 20s, started seeing, you know, the behind the curtain. But it was a lot. There was money to be made, and there were seats to fill by platforming people like Todd Bentley, my father, Sean Bowles, Mike Bickle, of course. And that money to be made, that power and that influence, souls to win, if you know, they probably put it in that context, that superseded the due diligence of taking the time to see whether or not these people are legitimate. And so this statement, I think, recognizes it's them first sort of starting to contend, which I agree, John, like, this is a good step in the right direction. Whether they just did this because they were pressured externally or not, who can say? But I mean, they're, regardless of their motivation, they're certainly making the right step. But then the other thing, and the very sobering thing, and the reason why this is like emotionally struck me when I saw this, is it's recognizing everything that you and I have been saying is true on this platform. Maybe not everything we are saying is confirmed, but like, I have been in a three, 4 year long battle with the public, with or not all of the public, but with many people. I have been trying to sound the alarm about Mike Bickle originally, and my dad, Bob Hartley. And I have been met with so much disdain and disregard and contempt from many people who are in leadership in the community that I was raised in. Now, it has progressed and it has gotten better. Like, the the acceptance of your and I's videos, John. I'm like that everybody in your audience is so supportive and so helpful, and I think that there's been much more acceptance even within the community as the years have passed. But when I first started speaking out against Mike Bickle, this was before I was on your platform, John, and when I was just someone who knew about Mike Bickle's behaviors because of my relationship with my mom and my relationship to my dad and seeing sort of behind the curtain, I was sounding an alarm. I remember I was the first one to talk to Chris Vallotton. At least this is how he framed it. I was the first person to talk to Chris Vallotton, a lead pastor at Bethel, about Mike Bickle. And he was like, yeah, I've heard the rumors. I don't know if they're true. And I, on the phone, was like, I can assure you they're true. And he kind of, on the phone, he actually wasn't super resistant to that on the phone. He was like, oh, I didn't realize that, because I was like, it literally involved my own mother. And I remember talking to one of the pastors at IHOP during some of this time too, where I spoke with him on the phone. And again, it was this sort of, I don't know, that we'll see whether or not this is true. And then on X and on Facebook and in my emails, I was getting hate mail about how I was accuser of the brethren, just like anybody who sounds the alarm, just like my mom was, just like
Deborah.
Oh, Deborah. Yes, of course. Like Deborah and all of the people who have spoken up. So my mom and Deborah being, and Tammy Woods, being the primary people who spoke out against Mike Bickle originally, Alan Hood, others. These people who sounded the alarm have largely been excommunicated from the New Apostolic Reformation community, had to, in order to speak out, there's all of these booklets and online emails. I mean, there's still some of this going on, just propaganda about Mike Bickle being attacked by demonic forces and us who were speaking out against him being agents of the demonic and all that sort of stuff. And certainly many found it extremely abhorrent that I would speak about my own father in these ways. And it is emotional. Like it causes me a weird sort of pain to see Bethel then, 3 years after the fact, in a statement, calmly wash their hands and be like, hey, we're not going to do this unless we have good evidence. That being said, following internal review and discussion, these four are no longer platform. You know, they don't get into the nitty gritty that I've had to get into of what and why these people are dangerous. But they recognize it. And so like the battle from the Bethel perspective is won. But for me, it is really heartbreaking because, I mean, it's just been so exhausting and so much. I so appreciate, you know, being able to get on here and talk with you and share about some of the things that have gone on in my childhood. But I have not appreciated or relished in the battle that I have had to fight to sound the alarm about my father and my spiritual father and many of the people who I grew up with and loved quite dearly. And to see it now sort of publicly recognized and affirmed that, yep, those things were going on. And by a church that would absolutely not do this unless they absolutely had to. You know, this is not them just doing it from PR sake. Like if they thought that these men were innocent, there is zero chance that this would be happening. So, you know, yet there will still be people who talk about the accusers of the brethren and we'll talk about how we should do it in different ways. I mean, even the later episodes that we're going to talk about that we've already recorded, but that are going to be in the next few weeks, we talk about Jen Johnson and her response to all of this. Now, this was before the public statement was made online, but Jen Johnson recorded and a sort of conversation that was so just frankly inappropriate. And we'll get into it in depth in the next episodes. But I mean, even Jen Johnson was recently just talking about how don't listen to people on social media and relegating people like you and me, John, to these social media voices who don't know what's going on, as if it wasn't my father and my spiritual father, you know, as if I wasn't deeply connected to the things that I was saying online. And I'm speaking, of course, about me personally. This is obviously involving many people who are sounding the alarm, who are beyond me. It's not like I'm the only person by any means who has been raising the sort of flag about these men's behaviors, but many of whom are doing so because they are directly involved, similar to me, and saw these things with their own two eyes and are going to social media and podcasts and because that is the only opportunity, that is literally the only way for them to be able to get their voice out and to speak about things like this. Because even when Bethel is recognizing it, they do so in this super Pontius Pilate, wash my hands of these things and walk away without talking at all about what is going on in the actual situation. You know, what are these men actually accused of? That is the actual work that has to be done to expose what is going on with something like this. You know, people could look at it and see it vague enough as like, oh, well, Bethel just, they have theological differences. They have issues about they, you know, pre-trib, post-trib rapture, like that. You could interpret this in ways to be like, oh, maybe they're Democrats. Maybe, you know, who knows? Why is Bethel distancing themselves from these four people? Could be anything. And it doesn't really hold any of the weight of what is actually going on.
Another thing I find really interesting. So I've been to churches where there were preaching circuits. And yeah. What I mean by that is you'd have a traveling evangelist who would just visit a church from time to time. And they were all in a circuit. There would be like, I don't know, 5, 6, 10 churches that they would travel to in their circuit. Whenever Bethel uses the word platforming and then takes the tone that they have, like I'm reading through this as we're talking just to refresh my memory, but it's talking about how some of the problems that they have are because of the platforming. It is an admission that it is a different type of thing than just normal evangelism. Whenever you read this and you understand how Pentecostal traveling minister evangelist circuits work, the people aren't, even though they're, you could call them quote unquote platformed, they're not really platformed in the same way. The people don't become super apostles in that type of environment.
Right.
I have been in churches where we had a traveling minister and had, later we learned there were huge flaws with this minister. I won't go into the details. And nobody cared because this wasn't the pastor of our church. Nobody cared. Yes, he visited. Yes, he preached. Yes, we enjoyed some of the things he said. Yes, we disagreed with some of the things he said. But our church was our church and our pastor was our pastor. We didn't have this situation where we were being told that the shepherd of our flock, our pastor, had co-shepherds that were platformed to co-shepherd our flock at various times. I don't know how to say that in a way that makes sense, because it doesn't make sense. That's the funny part.
Yeah.
But what they're admitting to is the fact that the system of platforming, not just what they're talking about that they did, they're actually addressing the system of platforming. This has a huge problem. This has consequences. And that's really, for me, that's even the bigger admission than the names that they've mentioned. We have a system where when we platform somebody, they become so elevated in respect that even our own church members will put themselves into situations where they might be under some type of abuse. And we have this broad audience who connects to us through this new apostolic networks that they connect to. those people are also at risk. So what we have is a situation where we have a bunch of sheep without a true shepherd. That is really, if you read through this and you understand what they're saying with the word platforming, that's really what they're talking about. They're talking about this system has failed us, but nowhere does it really describe that the system has failed. What they're doing, and I would say that this might be a negative if I read the argument. What they're doing is they have four scapegoats. So we have the system. Yeah. The system is creating victims. We see the victims, and here are four scapegoats. However, all of that said, to a person who came out of that system, which I did, I understand the reasons why it's difficult to break free from the system. And I'll still say this is a step in the right direction. They're moving in the right direction. But again, you have to come to the point where you don't look at it like you just said, where anybody who cries foul is an accuser of the brethren. Because what you're trying to say is, we're shepherds of a flock. We failed the flock. Some of those flock have left, like you. And whenever the flock has left and they say, hey, there's something wrong here, that's why I left, that's an accuser of the brethren? I don't think so. That's somebody who's saying, look, man, this system has failed me. Can you examine the system?
The fact that they aren't then reaching out to me or to my family, or I don't know with Sean Bowles, Mike Bickle, Todd Bentley, if the other people, but for Deborah, for Tammy, for my mom and for Mike Bickle's sake, like the people who have been impacted by these individuals and their platforms, you know, is Bethel reaching out apologetically to some of the women who were in the Bethel flock and who were abused? Are they reaching out to people who were given prophecies by my dad or Sean Bowles to apologize to them and take ownership for their sort of role in platforming these predators? I think the answer is no. And I'm back and forth because I'm so with you on that this is progress, this is moving forward. But when you talk about they got four scapegoats, yeah, it's hard not to feel like they are just trying to do damage control. And this is about the platform, and it's about public image, and it's kind of going back to the platform. That's the sort of central thing is whether or not Bethel's platform is secure so that they can influence as much people as possible and they can make as much money as possible. I'm sure that they talk about it as the former, but the latter certainly helps. You know, it just is hard not to see this as something that is done in order to salvage the platform.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. I don't know if you caught it or not. One commenter actually did, if you read the article that you sent me from Roy's report. But there's one statement in there. Actually, there's a few statements that use the same kind of language. But it says, the engagement of outside professionals earlier may have been helpful, and we could provide more open communications and offered clearer, timelier responses, the letter states. At times, our emphasis in internal discussions and confidential processes, here's the phrase, may have appeared to limit accountability. whenever you are issuing a public apology and you realize that there's something wrong and you realize that there have been people who are victims, you don't usually say may have appeared to limit accountability. Yeah. So it tells me that there's probably a little bit more going on. Likely there are some legal issues that we're not even aware of yet that's happening with all of this, because that's not the kind of language you use unless an attorney gets involved with this and says, okay, look, there's some real risk here. This is about to go nuclear. You must be very cautious with your words. That's the kind of verbiage that's in here. So for me, you have to look at it more on the historian side than the apology side, because it's an apology, yes, but it's a qualified apology. It'd be like if I walked up to you, Jed, and I slapped you in the face and I say, I'm sorry, but it may have appeared to have hurt the side of your face. Mm-hmm. You're going to say, what kind of apology was that? I may have appeared to slap you, Jed. Well, that's kind of what this is. It's a little bit of a slap in the face, which is why one of the people commented like that. But for me, I don't see that. Again, this is a step in the right direction. I don't see that as a problem because I understand the legal consequences that come with it. I just wonder to what extent that legal issue has grown, because behind the scenes, this could have grown to levels that we're only seeing just the beginning of what will be a nuclear bomb going off.
Yeah, well, and that whole, the term confidential too in there, where they talk about, hey, we have this sort of confidential process that we are going on behind the scenes. It makes it feel like there is this in-depth, you know, investigation that's going on, that like, hey, we're doing the due diligence behind the scenes. No, it wasn't, because I was there and it didn't happen like that. And you can't be certainly I can't say this definitively for anybody but besides my father's situation, but I mean, I called them, they did not call me. I sent emails to Bill Johnson, and yeah, I got one email and then I got no follow-up. I had one long conversation with Chris Valentin and Jason, one longer conversation with Jason Valentin, which again was heading in the right direction. I don't want to criticize them so much and not recognize the things that they have done right in the right step, which like I do at least appreciate that Chris Valentin and Jason Valentin spoke to me and wanted to hear about what I was saying. Had I not gone viral on Twitter, would they have done that? I don't know. I think I would like to think so, but going on viral on Twitter certainly helped and put pressure on them. But, you know, that was back in 2023, I think, and we're now in 2026. I mean, there's 2.5-3 years that have passed before this sort of, they've made different, like they sent out a letter to Bethel staff, so that like they've done things, but now they are publicly distancing themselves from my dad in a way that they are recognizing, you know, it's a different level of admission. And again, this is obviously not just about my dad, but about other individuals. So maybe they, you know, just added him to the list because they had several other individuals that they were needing to publicly deplatform. So they were like, well, might as well get them all out in one swoop. But the point is that they talk about this sort of, I saw their black box. I saw their confidential process. It wasn't anything. It literally was nothing. It was them. I'm sure that they've had conversations afterwards, but like they did not verify with me afterwards. Like, oh, okay, so Chris spoke to you about these particular things. Hey, can you give me some more details? Tell me, when you were talking about your father abusing alcohol before our conferences, like which conferences were those? Tell me more about, okay, when you were talking about how you printed out information that you didn't realize that he was using prophetically, like which conference was that? How did that happen? How could we change this system? How did we help enable your father? I mean, these are questions that if someone wanted to fix the situation, these are questions that you have to ask, right? And those questions were not asked. That investigation was not had with me. None of my family have been contacted by them. So when they are talking about, hey, we have this confidential process, you got to trust the process, we're doing it behind the scenes, you know, even with this sort of recognition, maybe, hey, maybe we should have said this before, and we're recognizing, you know, the impact of our platform. I mean, nothing's changed with that. No new investigation turned up anything. They weren't, you know, I wasn't getting contacted by independent investigators who were trying to get to the bottom of what was going on. I had a 2-hour conversation with Chris Fallotton, and that was sufficient to tell him. I'm not saying that that wasn't sufficient investigation, because it certainly was, because I, you know, I gave plenty of details. But it makes it seem like there is this big in-depth process, and there is this movement behind the scenes where the staff on Bethel is more interested in rooting out and finding deceivers and abusers and predators, and they are actively guarding, you know, shepherding. They are guarding the sheep, and that's just not how is. It legitimately, this is not me being overly critical. Like, I, from my perspective, I guess I will caveat it, but from perspective where I directly was involved with how they handled one of these four men, I can just affirm that there was no thorough process that involved the sort of investigation into my dad. There was no thought out process of how to prevent people like my dad to still be platformed by Bethel, at least not in any way that I was privy to and I saw, which, if you're wanting to do it well, I should be privy to that. And I understand that I've gotten on here and I have criticized them publicly, so maybe they're avoiding me and avoiding my family because they're like, oh, this is just going to get more attention to it. But I think that I have shown that I am pretty willing to have conversations because I want to see things change. I don't want to see John and I's numbers explode and get, you know, I am much more engaged in like doing these podcasts with you than like, so the Mike Winger video that I did that got like 600,000 views or whatever. Many times I've kind of regretted even doing that because I don't want the large exposure. I want change to happen, and I want to be able to articulate and talk to people who also want to see change, and I want to be able to share my insights with historians like yourself, John, who are trying to bring about change by really addressing the system that created the situation that my father was able to prey upon. Now, that being said, I would love to see your people subscribe to you and watch more of your videos and those videos go up. But the point is that this isn't done in order to get attention. This is done in order to get change. And it is heartbreaking to me that Bethel is recognizing that everything that I said was true and that everything that was going on with my dad and Mike Bickle and these others, like that, where there was smoke, there was fire. And yet they are only trying to put out the smoke and not trying to put out the fire. I can't say that definitively, but certainly from my perspective, they seem way more concerned with the smoke than the fire. And I think that that is really heartbreaking because it sort of dampens the idea that this won't happen again. Like that, I'm not confident that despite Bethel putting this and taking a step in the right direction, like, I don't know if they're going to platform people without doing their due diligence. I don't know if they're going to think about whether or not that they should be so gung-ho and invested in miracles and miracle working that they're not even going to question whether or not any of this is fake. I don't know if there's going to be any sort of hesitancy and responsibility with this. I hope so, but I am not optimistic.
I want to go back to something that you said, because I think that's important as it relates to this that not many people catch. You know how this works. You were around the upper tier. I was around the upper tier. I know others who were. This idea that things are happening because either someone is anointed or it's a divine providence by God. You know how this works, especially if you're a kid growing up watching it. Things happen because of coincidences, and every single coincidence, oh my gosh, God just came down in our midst. When you're behind the pulpit, that's how they would preach it. I mean, two people might happen to show up at Kroger at the same aisle at the same time, and they say, God just placed her right there in my path. I heard stories like this, right? To the audience who's not familiar with how it works in the upper tiers, they're thinking, wow, God is in our midst. Look at this. Those two people met in the aisle at Kroger. But to the inner circle, they don't even really realize that they're doing it. It just comes so naturally. God, every single thing is God inspired when you're a lead in this. The problem is, and this is one thing that I will say, Bethel probably doesn't know, because I was in the system. I know that I overlooked it when I was in it. Now that I get out, I look at just how foolish we were. But when you try to present that type of atmosphere where everything you do, God did it for you, and every single thing that could possibly happen, such as platforming an individual and suddenly his ministry blows up, God was in his midst. The moment you combine that with the prophetic, that is the recipe for disaster, because now people take it to the next level. Okay, this person's being platformed and they had a prophecy about him, so therefore God has elected this individual to bring God's children home. I mean, that's literally what the people in the audience are thinking. Now, the people who are on the platform, they have done this so much that it's not even really that they're lying. It's just like second nature.
Yeah.
They start speaking and straight out of their butt, they pull these things.
Yeah.
People in the pews have no idea that came straight out of his butt.
Yeah.
Whenever you have prophecies that come straight out of your butt, it's not really a prophecy. And the problem that we're seeing here is now they're starting to see this. They see that the platforming isn't working. But here's where it gets really, really touchy. Some of those people that they have even denounced, and now these four scapegoats, some of those people are tied to prophetic statements that they had about those people. So was that statement true? Did that really come from God? Did God really inspire them to speak about this individual and praise them and say, this is the greatest prophet I've ever known, or whatever is the thing that they pulled straight out of their butt? My point is, at some point, the congregation is going to realize when you're doing this, there's only so many statements you can pull out of your butt before you get caught.
Yeah.
And I think if this continues, and they're continuing in the right direction, I'm not going to deny that. If they continue in the right direction, here's one of the problems that they're going to face. It's a lie.
Mm.
When you pull a prophecy out of your butt, mm-hmm. and people realize that that didn't come true like you said, that came out right out of your back pocket, people know and can pick up on the lie. And what do you do with this? How do you turn a ship that's that large with that many people in a way that can help them get closer to God? Do you turn the ship, or do you do something else? I'm not going to say what they should do. I don't know where it's headed from there, but I can say that if I was in that congregation and I look at this report and I see these names, and in my memory, I'm remembering the prophetic statements about them, now I'm going to question every single prophecy that they have issued.
Yeah, and as you should, and as everyone should who looks at Bethel and looks at their miracle-making machine. I mean, it you have to question it. And I remember having conversations with my dad that were very interesting philosophical conversations that, for me at least, this was probably when I was in my early 20s, because I was writing this book about my dad, and we were talking about his stories. And my dad was always a very grand and effective storyteller. He would tell these stories about things that happened in his life, and you would believe him because he's has such a, he's such a bizarre character that he would get himself in these legitimately bizarre situations. And many of the stories had truth to them or were entirely true, but many of them were also either partially or completely fabricated. And he recognized that, and we talked even about that, and it was even a tongue-in-cheek thing in the book that I wrote. Like, it was called, I hope it's not Hereditary, The Mostly True Stories of My Father, Bob Hartley. So I have that tag of, like, the mostly true, because it sort of recognized, like, we got a big fish situation. He loved that movie, by the way. I don't know if you've seen it, but about the father who tells all of these grand stories, and then at his funeral, you all of these bizarre characters who he had talked about come to the funeral, and you know, he talked about a giant who was 12 foot tall, and there's some guy who comes to it who's like 7'8" or something like that, where it's like the big fish analogy, where the fish gets bigger. You caught a good big fish, but every time you tell a story, the fish gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And my dad was that type of storyteller, and we had these conversations of like, I remember my mom really disliked it, and I was like, well, I think that the point is to tell a good story. The point is to entertain. The point is to engage and get the message across. And I'm a fiction writer, so I do this purely in fiction. And so I was kind of like, well, what's the harm? Blending a little truth and fiction and telling these stories. And I still think that to some extent. I still think that, you know, if you're listening to a pastor and you're hearing him tell some stories and he's fudging a little bit to get that emphasis across, I'm fine with that. Like, I get why people do that, to entertain and get the message and point across. But in that sense, you had a situation where my father had decided that the impact was more important than the truth. In fact, the impact was the only thing that mattered with his storytelling. And Hollywood will do that, and storytellers in general will do that. What you now have is you have a church who has decided that impact is more important than everything. And that is leading to all of these situations where now it's not just stories being told. Now it's prophecies being told, where truth matters. Whether or not you tell a story that's kind of like an allegorical tale, whether or not it happened doesn't matter, because it's about the message and many of Jesus's parables like didn't reference to things that literally happened, and that doesn't matter because it's about the story and the message that's being told. But when it comes to prophecy, when it comes to miracles, the truth matters not just a little. Like, the truth is contingent, is necessary for it to matter. But Bethel has decided that impact is more important than truth. In fact, impact is the only thing that matters. And so therefore, if all of this impact is happening, if people are being, if a spiritual frenzy is being worked up, so you're going to conferences and people are weeping in the chairs, that's all that matters, right? And I think that there's this sort of excuse in the head, and I know this because I did it myself, because it's like, well, if it leads people to God, it has to be good. But the truth is that it doesn't actually always lead people to God. It leads people to spiritual frenzy. It doesn't lead people to actually have a deeper spiritual understanding, because to have understanding, you have to have knowledge based on at least a kernel of truth. And so there is instead frenzied deception that is being spread. So this whole idea that, well, it's leading to God, one, that goes completely out the window. And secondly, that doesn't negate the fact that it's deception. Even if like someone's life improves and they feel like, oh, well, I got this Bob Hartley prophecy, and even though it wasn't true, it still led me closer to God. Yeah, that doesn't negate the fact that it was still deception. Like, it's not this consequentialist standpoint, like I just don't think that that is morally true. Like I think that the truth of the situation matters deeply, and the impact and consequences of that, if not felt in the immediate or not felt in the person, there will be consequences. There always are. Some, like the piper must always be paid for these things. And the fact that Bethel is giving a platform to people who are doing these deceptive and abusive things, the consequences of that are churning. And the only reason why Bethel is now doing something about it is because it's affecting their impact. It's not because they had a moral awakening. Maybe perhaps they did have a moral awakening, but it was because they saw people say, I don't know if I want to, this is bad for the brand. I don't want to listen to Bethel music. I don't want to go to their prophetic conferences. I'm sure their prophetic conferences numbers are down. Like I am positive their prophetic conference numbers are dipping. One, because most of their big ticket profits have now been embroidered in scandals, so they can't have their big ticket profits come to speak at their conferences. So who are they going to put on the billing? But also, I think that there's a lot of people who are just suspicious of, rightfully so, suspicious of Bethel. And I think that that is what has lit the fire underneath them for change. So I really do think that until Bethel changes its priorities, until it doesn't put impact as the only priority, and with impact, money, if those two things are properly relegated underneath the virtues of like truth, honesty, integrity, sexual morality, like just morality in general, if those things are quite appropriately put at the top of the priority, then that's when we're going to see a change here. And I don't think it's happened yet, but hopefully we are pressuring them to start thinking about that at the very least.
And at least it's a step in the right direction. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, John.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.